Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to board meeting number three of the 2011-2012 school year. Honoring our commitment to be as punctual as possible, while our colleagues, those who are joining us, will join us shortly. Please stand and join us in the singing of the national anthem. Madam Secretary, roll call, please.
Mr. Chair, Trustee Jens and Trustee McKenzie are absent. All other trustees are present.
Thank you, Madam Secretary. Communications from the board chair. You'll note on your agenda that we will be conducting a joint virtual meeting with Ottawa-Carleton School District School Board from 5 to 6 p.m. today. In order to accommodate this meeting, the second opportunity for comments from the public and staff group representatives will take place at 4:30 rather than at 5 p.m. We will also take a recess no later than 4:50 in order to allow for the technical setup for this joint meeting. The final public meeting of the School Closure Moratorium Committee will be taking place this evening at 7 p.m. Trustee McKenzie and myself will not be able to attend, and Trustees Shipka and Spencer have volunteered to fill in and assist Trustee Hoffman as formal representatives of the board. I would like to ask concurrence from my colleagues, on the designation of Trustee Shipka and Trustee Spencer as the board's representatives on this committee this evening. Seeing no opposition, that decision is supported. October is Learning Disabilities Awareness Month across Canada and is intended to improve and deepen the awareness of learning disabilities. Most people are not aware that a learning disability is a lifelong condition that affects a minimum of 1 in 10 Canadians of all people with average or above average intelligence. Learning disabilities cross all ages, genders, socioeconomic, cultural, and linguistic groups. It is likely that during your life you will be touched directly or indirectly by someone with a learning disability in your relationships with family, friends, or co-workers. October 2nd was Custodial Workers Recognition Day. The district appreciates and values the members of QP Local 474, our custodial staff, who ensure that our buildings are comfortable, clean, and safe for our students and staff, and recognizes the contributions custodial staff make in supporting teaching and learning in the classroom. And appropriate timing, our president of Local 474 just made his appearance. October 5th was World Teachers Day, a day set aside by the world community to celebrate teachers. The district appreciates and values the Edmonton Public Teachers and recognizes the central role they play in nurturing and guiding infants, children, youth, and adults through the lifelong learning process. In recognition of these days, the Board of Trustees and the administration placed ads in local and provincial newspapers. Again, thank you to these staff members. Communications from the superintendent. Mr. Superintendent.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have one item to bring to share with the board. Mr. Chairman, I'm pleased to share with the board my recent experience in Madrid, Spain, participating in the 12th annual seminar for administrators of programs for international educational cooperation hosted by the Education Ministry of Spain. The topics of the conference related to bilingual education in particular, with an emphasis on achievement outcomes for students, assessment frameworks, and latest innovations in programming support. I was pleased to share with the conference participants the work we are doing in the district currently and the new innovations emerging in the area of technology in support of bilingual and immersion education, specifically as well as second language education generally. I'm very proud to say that the long-standing commitment of the board and of the district leadership and staff expertise has helped Edmonton Public Schools to continue to be a world leader in second languages education. Our district has made a commitment to the Common European Framework of Reference for Second Languages Outcomes, which allows students in immersion and bilingual programs to earn international language credentials, allowing students to attend foreign universities and colleges, as well as to participate in international business opportunities. Other participating delegates expressed interest in following up with the district to see how our work may help them achieve their goals. It was indeed a proud moment for Edmonton Public Schools. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Superintendent. Item E, minutes from the board meeting number 2, September 27, 2011. Trustee Cleary, would you move that these minutes be approved as printed?
I so move.
Thank you, Trustee Cleary. Are there any additions or corrections to these minutes? Seeing none, I would call the vote on these minutes being received as printed. All those in favor? That is carried unanimously. Item F, comments from the public and staff group representatives. At this point in the agenda, we have provided an opportunity to hear comments from the public and staff on educational issues. 20 minutes may be set aside. Comments should be kept to approximately 3 minutes per speaker. As I mentioned earlier, there will be a second opportunity for comments from the public and staff group representatives at 4:30 p.m. today rather than at 5 in order to accommodate our virtual meeting with the Ottawa-Carleton Board. Are there any comments from our public or staff groups? Seeing none. Moving on to reports, item G, report number two of the report number one of the conference committee from the meeting held September 27, 2011. Trustee Jans, our conference chair, is absent, so I will call upon Vice Chair Hoffman to introduce the item and move recommendation. Trustee Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move that report number one of the conference committee from the meeting held September 27th, 2011 be received and considered.
Thank you, Trustee Hoffman. Calling the vote on recommendation number one. All those in favor? That is carried unanimously. Trustee Hoffman, recommendation number two, please.
I move the nomination of Trustee Ripley for the position on the Public School Boards Association of Alberta, PSBAA Standing Committee on Intergovernmental Political Relations and the PSBAA Annual General Meeting be approved.
Thank you, Trustee Hoffman. Are there any trustee comments or questions? Seeing none, calling the vote on this recommendation. All those in favor, please signify. That is carried unanimously. Thank you, Trustee Hoffman. Good job pinch hitting on short notice. Item number three, a motion re the audit committee. Now, we do have a time-sensitive presentation from AGAL Canada at 2:45. I'm going to be hopeful that we might be able to move through this recommendation in the next 35 minutes. So we will begin, and if we fail to do so, we'll simply resume following the presentation from Dr. Taylor. So with that, I would call upon Trustee Cleary to introduce the motion and move the motion. Trustee Cleary. This is a motion re the audit committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. recommendation is that, number one, that the external audit committee members receive compensation equal to trustee per diem, to a maximum of 6 meetings per year. Second recommendation, that the audit committee be comprised of three trustee members, one of which is the board chair. Number three, that the term of the audit committee be 3 years for external members, with the first term set to expire October 2013, and that the trustee terms be set for 1 year like all other trustee standing committees. Number four, recommendation that the terms of reference for the audit committee be reviewed and revised accordingly by the administration, with consideration given to ASBA recommendations in order to implement this in the current year. The motion before you is to assist the Board of Trustees in fulfilling its duties related to governance and oversight. Trustees will form a standing committee with the appointment of external members who have the accounting, senior financial management, and other business experience to understand public sector accounting and audit standards. I would ask that each recommendation be considered on its own and voted on separately, as decisions need to be made as to the external members' compensation, the makeup of audit committee as a standing committee, terms of audit committee for external members and trustees, and decision finally on terms of reference reflecting the audit committee as decided upon today. Duties of the audit committee would be captured under the terms of reference, specifically outlining financial reporting process, internal control framework, risk management practices, performance and function of the board's internal and external auditors, and also the board's compliance with its obligations under legislation. I truly believe that this will strengthen the trustees' ability to fulfill their role of governance and financial oversight of the district, and I am open to the dialogue and debate on this motion.
Thank you, Trustee Cleary. Madam Chair, do we require a formal board vote? Excuse me, Madam Secretary, do we require a formal board vote on considering each of these recommendations individually? Just make that decision. Thank you, Madam Secretary. I have Trustee Spencer in the queue. I was going to open it up to trustee comments or questions. Trustee Spencer, I noticed you in the queue pretty quickly, so perhaps you have a broad comment before we enter into debate.
Actually, Trustee Cleary did address it. I was going to move that we divide into four different items.
Okay. Thank you, Trustee Spencer. So we are considering recommendation number one in the audit committee motion. My colleagues have that recommendation before them. I'm opening the floor for trustee comments or questions in response to item number one of the motion. Trustee comments or questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Trustee Hoffman.
A question to the mover, I guess, is, would be, why was it the mover's intent to have external audit committee members receive an honorarium for the meetings, or what was the rationale behind her moving that first recommendation?
Trustee Clear.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The rationale behind that is that we're looking to attract two external audit committee members, and I think that it just strengthens the case that we're looking for two professionals to give their time, and I feel that it would strengthen our ability to attract and not just volunteers that just might think that it's a good idea, but it's actually a worthy role, and in exchange for their wisdom and expertise on the committee, I feel that we need to compensate equal to that commitment.
Trustee Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When I was considering this, I thought back to the per diem motion that was passed during the last school year, and recalled that members serving on advisory committee or task force committee who are not elected representatives, rather volunteer representatives or recruited representatives, do not receive such compensation. So I feel that it would be dismissing their contributions, which I think are extremely valuable. And I also don't think that the minimal compensation that a per diem acknowledges would be a valid incentive for the kind of work that we're expecting out of these contributors, as well as the contributors we've had on advisory committees and task force in the past. So therefore, to ensure continuity, consistency, and acknowledging that we're in extremely tight financial situations. And I think that members of the committee, particularly taxpayers who want to ensure that their contributions, their tax contributions are being spent responsibly, would be willing to participate. And if there is a problem attracting quality people, which I don't think we've had in the past with any of our other committee work, then I'd be open to reconsidering. But at this point, I would be opposing this move to have per diem compensation. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Trustee Hoffman. Trustee Ripley.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I just have a question about chartered accountants. I'm not one, so I don't know the answer, but am I correct, Mr. Chair, in thinking that chartered accountants volunteer or are required as part of sort of their code of conduct, to, for lack of a better term, to volunteer their time?
Mr. Smith, please. Mr. Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. CGAs all have the professional ethics that they would be volunteering for some of these courses, these opportunities. So it is part of continuing education as well as their professional responsibility to the community.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Trustee Ripley.
Thank you very much for that answer. Given that answer, I too would not support providing a per diem for the two external members. I believe that the process by which the administration will find qualified people will ensure that we have top-notch people, that a per diem is, as Trustee Hoffman said, probably not an incentive. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Trustee Ripley. Trustee Shipke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just quoting from the report on the next page, the appendix, that mentions here that two of the three boards did not compensate the member. These are the additional members on their audit committees. And so, but presuming they were able to find competent people with financial backgrounds to serve. And so, and there are quite a variety of ways that our board could attract CAs and people with accounting backgrounds to serve. So I would prefer that we avoid paying a per diem and first see if we can attract suitable people and then go from there. So I would have concerns about paying a per diem as well, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Trustee Shipley. Further trustee comments or questions? I will offer a comment. I'm satisfied that if two of our fellow Metro boards have been successful in securing the participation of qualified experts, chartered accountants, to serve on their audit committee, that without compensation, that we will be able to likewise attract a high-quality individual. It was actually informative to me that this is part of their professional obligations. And I think in these economic times, for us to be giving out per diems, unless it's absolutely necessary, I just think that's something we should be resisting. So I'm afraid I will not be able to support this recommendation. Any further comments from my colleagues? Trustee Cleary, would you like to close on this part of the debate?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have heard the wisdom of my colleagues. I did also some research on my own, and not just from the report that we received. And I did see some large metro boards that were compensating, so I feel that I'll leave this part of the motion to stand, and we shall vote on it. Thank you.
Thank you, Trustee Cleary. Seeing no further trustees in the queue, I will call the vote on recommendation number one of this motion. All those in favor, please signify. Trustee Cleary, all those opposed. Trustee Johnner, Trustee Shipka, Trustee Spencer, Trustee Ripley, Trustee Colburn, and Trustee Hoffman. That recommendation is defeated. Recommendation number two, opening the floor to trustee comments or questions. This is regarding the composition of the audit committee. Trustee comments or questions? Trustee Ripley.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. This is for me, this recommendation is the most significant one. This would be a big change for the board in practice. As we all know, the audit committee in the past has been composed of a committee of the whole. And I did note, however, in the report that there, somewhere there's a comment, I think it's on page 3, that boards seem to be moving towards having a committee of 3 to 4 trustees plus external members. So that, I wonder why that is. And I wonder if the mover could comment about why she feels that a smaller committee of trustees, who would then obviously report to the full board, would be more, would be better than a committee of the whole hearing what the external auditor has to say, understand, sort of going with the flow and understanding the financial position of the district, which has been my experience to date as a trustee.
Trustee Cleary.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The rationale behind the second recommendation is that forming it to be a trustee standing committee allows more in-depth consultation with the external members. I found that last year, actually, in practicality, there was very few questions and time spent with the conference committee as a whole, because I know it was a very time-sensitive thing, and I found that when we did the training with ASBA and financial literacy, I think, like I mentioned in my preamble, that it would definitely strengthen support for trustees and embarking on that work, and then, of course, bringing it to the conference committee. So I really would like to emphasize the fact that trustees' ability to fill the role of oversight, financial oversight of the district and governance, a trustee standing committee could do a lot of in-depth work in this area and then bring it forth. So that was the rationale between why I would strike a audit committee to be a standing committee with 3 trustees.
Thank you, Trustee Cleary. Trustee Ripley, anything further?
Thank you. I just wonder if the administration would be able to comment about the advantage of the of doing more in-depth work. Is there a need for the board to be delving more deeply into our financial affairs? What would be the implications of that,
Mr. Superintendent? Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think the key point here would be that the board, committee of the whole, or the entire board, all members need to have a level of comfort and confidence in the financial statements relative to our district financial statements, our reporting to Alberta Education, as well as reporting to our communities, and that the level of confidence of trustees is certainly related to the quality of reports that your administration brings forward, as well as the expertise that external members will be able to bring in terms of clarity, questions of the administration that we need to clarify, but also be able to potentially translate that information in helpful, constructive ways for the board in terms of ensuring that the board is feeling confident that the information is not only accurate but represents expenditures in the areas that the board has established as priority areas for expenditure. And so, Mr. Chairman, as I understand it, the intent of a smaller audit committee would be that a lot of that work would be done within that particular committee, and be brought forward for consideration of the highest level summary for the entire conference committee to hear and understand. The question whether the whole committee of the whole can achieve that depth of knowledge, common knowledge and understanding, depends entirely on all of the members of the board and the length of time that the board wishes to expend on these financial reports. Sometimes a smaller committee can get through more of the details in a quicker period of time. But those are all different considerations and depends entirely on the values that the board places on its need to be involved in this particular process. This would, as the trustee has mentioned, this would be a departure from our current practice.
Thank you, Mr. Superintendent. Trustee Ripley, anything further?
No, thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Trustee Spencer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have a question for the board chair, and that is this motion specifies that one of the three trustee members would be the board chair. I know that the board chair certainly has a more challenging schedule than some of the other trustees. Traditionally, the audit committee has been chaired by the conference chair as opposed to the board chair, and I think that's one of the reasons for that. So perhaps I could get a sense from you as to whether a board chair would have the time in his schedule to be part of an audit committee, which theoretically would meet more often than under the current model. Thank you.
Thank you, Trustee Spencer. Well, we don't know how often this new committee will meet. Our past experience is that the audit committee meets twice a year. It may be that this committee will meet three or four times a year. I would not say that that would be so onerous for the board chair that it would complicate his or her life in an unreasonable manner. I do think that the board chair, of course, is called upon to understand and speak to the financial complexity of running a district of 190 schools. So I think it will be additional work for the board chair, but I would largely support the importance of the board chair being part of the audit committee. So I guess that would be my best response. Trustee Spencer, anything further?
No, thank you.
Any further comments or questions? Trustee Shipka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. At the moment, support this motion of three members. I think it would help to focus those members on the task. We see that at least one of the other boards are doing that, and considering that for adding two more audit committee members, that potentially the committee of the whole would be nine members, and I think that number could be quite extensive and more practical to have a committee of five versus potentially 11. So I think this is a good proposal. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Trustee Shipka. Trustee Hoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As a first-term trustee, if this had been in place last year, I'm not confident that I would have put my name forward, perhaps at that point in time, having not served a previous term. But I do feel like the questions I asked supported my understanding of district operations as well as hopefully other members of the board in district operations. And I worry that other first-term trustees in the future, if we do reduce the number of people participating in the in-depth discussion at the preliminary stages, might not have that opportunity to engage and represent their opinions and the opinions of those that they're representing here at the Center for Education. So I think that it's important to have all members at the table, or at least have the opportunity to be at the table and engage in early stage discussions when it comes to the audit. I definitely support the idea of having external audit committee members, but I do not support the idea of limiting the number of trustees participating in the discussion and the opportunities to learn and also to ask those really in-depth questions that do inform the report writing that our admin staff do to ensure that every question that we have is answered and hopefully the questions that other members of the public have. So with great consideration, I'm going to choose to oppose this reduction in the number of trustee members sitting on the audit committee.
Thank you, Trustee Hoffman. Trustee Shipka, a second time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If supposing that this committee was a committee of three members, would other trustees still be permitted to participate in those meetings? And Mr. Chair?
It's my understanding, and Madam Secretary could correct me if necessary, it's my understanding that trustees can participate in committee meetings in terms of being observers at the moment, but not be vocal and certainly not be participating in votes. Although I recall that Trustee McKenzie has a motion before the board that would give trustees the opportunity as observers to actually engage in discussions of committee meetings but not participate in a vote. So really it's a bit of an uncertain landscape at the moment. The current practice is that we would trustees could attend those meetings but not be active participants in those meetings, simply observe. Would that be a correct synopsis, Madam Secretary? Trustee Shook, anything further?
No, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Trustee Ripley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to confirm that as with, through yourself or perhaps the administration, that as with all committees, they report back to the board and there is information shared at that time, at which point all members of the board can ask questions, whatever they wish to ask. Is that correct, Mr. Chair?
That would be my understanding, yes. Trustee Ripley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Trustee John.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure if I'm in favor of this motion or not. I'm kind of sitting on the fence a little bit, but one of the thoughts that I had was the complexity of scheduling committee meetings often. You know, if this motion were to pass, I would certainly be interested in sitting, listening, learning, increasing my depth of understanding, even though I may not step forward for the audit committee. That's why I'm somewhat favorable to the committee of the whole. But scheduling, from what I've seen already in the past, that, you know, I'd like to sit on policy, in the policy committee meetings, albeit I'm not on that committee. But so when scheduling, I think it might be a little problematic if it's that it might overlap with other committees. That's just a thought I had. So I'm not sure if I'm in favor of this motion or not. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Trustee Johnner. Any further trustee comments or questions? I, too, have grappled with this recommendation. I do see a smaller committee improving board efficiency. I would agree that it would likely allow for more in-depth examination of audit committee business, but I am concerned about the loss in building capacity that a reduced committee would create, because the reality will be that there will only be three trustees, and frankly, over a period of years, if you had a board chair serve two or three terms in a row, it wouldn't be three new trustees every year. It could be two new trustees that are serving on this committee. And so the opportunity that Trustee Hoffman spoke to of all trustees being exposed to the business of the audit committee and building skills and knowledge and experience in order to more completely understand the complexity of our financial issues and auditing processes, I think would be compromised. So I have some conflicting arguments there. But I think for me, the final consideration is that we are creating a new process. We don't know exactly what these audit committee meetings will look like now that we will have professional accountants participate in these audit committee meetings. And I think the board should have an opportunity to experience one or two of these meetings and judge for themselves what this new working environment is like and what the board's comfort level is in supporting a reduced composition format. So with that in mind, I will not support this recommendation. Last call for comments or questions on this recommendation. Seeing none, Trustee Cleary, would you like to close?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Nothing further on recommendation number two.
Thank you, Trustee Cleary. With that in mind, seeing no further trustees in the queue, I will call the vote on recommendation number two. All those in favor, please signify. That will be Trustee Shipka, Trustee Spencer, Trustee Ripley, and Trustee Cleary. All those opposed, Trustee Johnner, Trustee Colden, and Trustee Hoffman. That recommendation is carried. And I think with the permission of Dr. Taylor, who probably won't oppose starting early, I'm going to forego entering into debate and discussion on recommendation number four. And if it's agreeable to Dr. Taylor, I will ask her to come forward and begin the EGAL presentation. We'll take a break. So with great pleasure, I would like to introduce Dr. Catherine Taylor, Professor and Director of Academic Programs and Administration, Faculty of Education, University of Winnipeg. Welcome, Dr. Taylor, and please begin your AGAL presentation and take any seat that you would like. We will accommodate your presence.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I ask to address the board this afternoon in connection with your draft policy on sexual orientation and gender identity. I know that this can be a contentious issue, and I commend you, all of you, for your leadership. I want to cover a lot of ground in my 10 minutes this afternoon, and I understand the 10 minutes is a strict 10 minutes. So with your indulgence, I'll barrel through nonstop here. I served as the lead researcher for a large-scale study of Canadian high school students on issues affecting gender and sexual minority students. Some of our findings bear directly on your proposed policy, specifically the legitimacy of the issue and the need for standalone policy. Our study set out to answer these two research questions. How do diversely situated Canadian students experience the climate of their schools in this regard? And what kinds of interventions are associated with better or worse climates? And after 18 months of data collection, ending in June 2009, we had 3,607 participants. The whole project report is available at agal.ca. But I've tried to reduce the great wealth of data provided by these students to six key lessons that they have to offer educators. First, schools are indeed unsafe and disrespectful for sexual and gender minority students. In the area of symbolic violence, for example, 70% of all participants, gay and straight, reported hearing expressions such as "that's so gay" every day in school, sometimes to mean homosexual, most often to mean stupid or worthless. Who you are makes a difference to how unsafe high school seems for sexual and gender minority students, as you can see in this slide, with transgender students being most likely to see school as unsafe because they are taking the most harassment. But almost half of heterosexual students agreeing that, yes, at least one unavoidable area of my school is unsafe for LGBTQ students, most often change rooms, washrooms, and corridors, all very difficult to avoid in a day at school. We also asked students whether they had been personally victimized about their sexual or gender identity in various ways during the previous 12 months. And again, the pattern holds, as you can see in this slide. Transgender students are most likely to have been harassed, followed by lesbian, gay, and bisexual students, followed by heterosexual students on most sexual and gender diversity indicators, as you can see here. And these numbers point to everyday or levels of everyday victimization and the depression, anxiety, fear, and weakened school performance associated with it that are far in excess of most adults' experiences and that would bring most of us to our knees if we had to face it every day as we went to work. When we move on to impacts, we see that students who experience this harassment feel unsafe and less attached to their school community. We did not ask directly about suicidality, but we can, sadly, connect to the literature which links these measures to suicidality. As these findings and many, many others from the survey show, the more socialized one or more socially marginalized one is, the more likely one is to be treated badly and to suffer trauma in Canada's schools. So lesson three from our participants is diversity equals danger. The farther you are from the mainstream or the majority, the more danger you're in at school. So how does this jive with the lessons that students get at school? On the one hand, schools promise safety and respect for all students. On the other, students witness disrespect of sexual and gender minority students every day
and they often see their teachers look the other way. The combined pedagogical effect of these conflicting discourses is the message that human rights are for everyone but gay people. If it applied to them, our teachers would be doing something about all the abuse that they take. The bad news from our students is that little is done in most schools to address homophobia. The good news is that in schools where even small efforts have been made, students report a better climate. So lesson 5 from Canada's youth is, the problem is widespread, but perhaps not all that deep. To get at the impact of interventions, we analyzed students' experiences of sexual and gender minority harassment procedures, curriculum, and gay straight alliance clubs against their experiences of climate harassment and impacts. This slide shows that sexual and gender minority students who knew their schools have anti-homophobic harassment procedures were much more likely to report positively on their school climate and school attachment. Conversely, LGBTQ students who reported their schools have policies for reporting homophobic harassment were much less likely to have been harassed or to feel unsafe or to feel depressed about school. And what these numbers show is that harassment reporting policy doesn't completely transform school culture, but it does make a significant difference. Similarly, in schools where students have been allowed to form a gay-straight alliance club, sexual and gender minority students feel much better about their school communities, as you can see on this slide. We also asked students about curriculum, and very little curriculum was reported, generally just a class or two in the previous 12 months. But lesbian, gay, bisexual, trans, and queer and questioning students who had been exposed to even a little LGBTQ inclusive content had stronger school attachment and they felt less isolated. However, they were no less likely to be verbally or physically harassed. And this makes sense. Minimal curricular action, one or two classes, might be enough to affirm LGBTQ students and their passive heterosexual supporters, but not enough to have an impact on the committed homophobes who are doing most of the direct victimization. And in the absence of substantive curricular inclusion, which is ultimately necessary, the heavier hand of anti-homophobic harassment policy is needed to deter those hardcore harassers. Most of the findings of our study more or less confirm what researchers in the area would have predicted, but not this finding. This number is much, much higher than I expected. 58% of heterosexual students responded that they too are distressed to some degree when they hear homophobic comments. Whatever the reason for their distress, and there are many, some are targets, some have loved ones who are targets, some are ashamed for participating in it, some are simply kind people. Whatever the reason, this 58% suggests that there is a great deal of untapped solidarity out there on this issue. We know that LGBTQ students wish their teachers were more proactive on the issue. This finding suggests that heterosexual students too would welcome some help from the adult world in this regard. Generic policies have never worked for homophobia and transphobia, and they never will. We've given them a good try across the country. Pardon me. What the climate survey statistics add up to ultimately is an entirely preventable boatload of misery that is caused by insult, exclusion, and harassment. And on the basis of the evidence from our students, our final report recommends that specific LGBTQ-inclusive policies, both reactive and proactive, be developed and thoroughly implemented at every level of the school system, that the safety and well-being of groups at especially high risk be addressed. that students be supported in their efforts, above all, that teachers who have developed expertise in the issues be consulted. And thank you so much for the opportunity to address this board.
Thanks very much, Dr. Taylor, for taking time out of, I know it is a very hectic day, to share some of those thoughts with us. Trustee Ripley, would you move that this report be received for information?
So moved, Mr. Chair, and may I ask a question?
Absolutely. Sorry, we would be delighted to take a few more minutes of your time, if that were possible, Dr. Taylor.
Charmed, I'm sure.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, through you, I was interested in, well, thank you very much. It was all interesting and interesting information. Point number five, you talked about the problem is widespread but not deep. And you talked about some of the things that could be done to, make an improvement in the situation for LGBTQ students and presumably all students, actually.
That's right.
The harassment reporting procedure, in the new Education Act that's happening in Alberta, there is a specific reference to the fact that students will be accountable for reporting bullying of any type, et cetera. And at a recent community meeting, we had two tables of students sitting there saying, we're really worried about that section of the School Act, because if we report it, who's going to keep us safe? And I just wondered if you have any wisdom to share with us on that, because I think if students don't feel safe reporting, then it continues, doesn't it?
Yeah, I've heard that kind of comment from students before, and I sympathize with it. I think what's needed there is a whole school approach to LGBTQ inclusive education, so that all students know that every single adult in that building backs the policy and will be there to defend anyone who is harassed. In Winnipeg School Division, for example, what they did was mandate half-day human rights anti-homophobia workshops for every single staff member, all 5,000 staff members of the division, not only teachers and administrators, but groundskeepers, bus drivers, cafeteria workers, and so on. And it was made clear to every employee that it was their job to look out for the safety and well-being of all students, and in particular of LGBTQ students. I don't think that completely solves the problem. We know that some harassment goes on when adults are not present. But I think that having that whole school approach to endorsing the policy would go a long way towards preventing the kind of backlash against people who report that you're talking about.
Thank you, Dr. Taylor. Trustee Ripley?
Just to say thank you very much for the answer. It may be a useful comment, certainly, when developing the regulations for the administration to consider. Thank you.
Thank you, Trustee Ripley. Further trustee comments or questions? Trustee Johnner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
A reminder to my colleagues, we've set aside 10 minutes for trustee comments or questions, so I urge everyone to be as succinct as we usually are.
Thank you. I will bear that in mind.
All right.
My question, Mr. Chair, is there was a comment about generic policies are ineffective, and we have the that they've been ineffective across the country, pardon me.
Mm-hmm.
So my question is, where are the locations across the country where these examples have taken place?
Dr. Taylor?
Thank you for the question. Again, if I could just go back to the example of Winnipeg School Division, the reason that they developed their standalone policy 13 years ago was that they had really good generic policies in place for some time, and LGBTQ students were reporting to trustees that they weren't being protected, that their teachers were interpreting the generic safe schools policies as applying to everything but homophobic comments and homophobic harassment.
when board hearings were held, the trustees finally decided to back a standalone policy when harassment of people coming to make delegations like my own grew so ugly and violent that people were screaming in the faces of children that their lesbian or gay parents were going to go to hell. And trustees finally said, okay, now we see that this really is a problem that is not covered by our codes of human rights and respect for all people.
Thank you, Dr. Taylor.
But that's one of many examples from across the study, from across the country.
Can you list any other places in addition to Winnipeg?
Well, Metropolitan Toronto School Board would be another one. Vancouver's school board, the entire blessed province of Newfoundland and Labrador, in Manitoba, Louis Riel School Division, Seven Oaks School Division, Evergreen School Division have all moved forward to develop standalone policies after it became evident that no one was taking action on homophobic harassment.
Thank you.
Thank you, Trustee John and Trustee Hoffman.
Thank you. You touched briefly on families, and I just wanted to share a quick anecdote that I heard from a parent in my ward about going around to high schools looking for a high school for their daughter in grade 10 who self-identifies as heterosexual but has lesbian mothers, and how much happier the mom was walking into a school where she saw a triangle saying that it was a safe space on the counselor's door, and how as a family member that made her really excited about that high school, knowing that she would be, that her daughter would be able to talk about her family in some sort of open context. So I'm just wondering, you talked about there being at least one unsafe school space in the survey. Were there questions about having at least one identified safe space as well? I don't think it was highlighted in PowerPoint, but did you ask students about that?
We didn't ask that question, no.
And in some of these other jurisdictions where they've had specifically targeted LGBT policies, is that something that the regulations have pointed to down the road, that there be an identified safe space in every school?
I don't know that that's been attached to policy. I do know that Safe Spaces campaigns have been conducted in school divisions and universities across the country. On my office door, for example, at the University of Winnipeg, there's a rainbow triangle that signifies to students that I'm a safe person to come to with an issue about sexual or gender diversity.
Have there been any studies that you're aware of on how that affects the climate or the culture of the school, having an overall policy, of course, for the whole school being the ideal, but having an overt symbol that there is somebody safe to talk to? Are there studies that you're aware of, particularly at the K-12 level, that have targeted that question?
I'm drawing a blank on that right now, but if you like, I'll email
if there's an opportunity
the board chair with that information. I'll look for that information.
Thanks.
I think that would be an example of the kind of intervention that would perhaps show that homophobia is widespread, but perhaps not all that deep. Just having a triangle signifying openness to sexual and gender diversity can be enough to make the difference between, you know, something and nothing, you know, a desert and an oasis, and it makes it can make a huge difference to sexual and gender diversity students.
Thank you, Dr. Taylor.
Thank you, Trustee Hoffman. Last question goes to Trustee Spitzer.
Once again, I win. thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you very much for your presentation today. This is, I think, one of the most important issues facing school districts right now. In the United States currently, there's the beginning of what seems like a nasty election, and we have a couple of candidates in Rick Santorum and Michelle Bachmann who are deliberately scapegoating LGBT people as part of their campaign strategy. we've seen in Canada recently, the advertisement placed by Dr. Charles McBenty on the I'm a Girl, Don't Confuse Me, had that was quite notorious. And I just wonder, how much can schools do when there's this kind of climate of hostility toward people who are different?
Well, schools certainly don't create homophobia or transphobia, but students spend, I don't know, 6 to 8 hours or more every day of their lives for 10 months a year for 12 years in schools. I don't think that teachers or principals or trustees alone can shift a homophobic culture that is not of school origin, but adults can send a message to students that supports them in their own efforts. And I think working together, we've seen examples of schools where it feels perfectly safe for students to be gay or lesbian or bisexual or trans or two-spirit. And these can be schools where you'd least expect it. For example, in Winnipeg, there's a school called Tech Voc. It's the vocational high school in the north end core area of the city. And there are inclusive posters on the walls, and there are a couple of events a year, and it's not cool in that school anymore to be homophobic. If someone harasses somebody else in a homophobic way, other students do intervene and support. So I don't think it's time yet to give up on the capacity of children and youth not to be bigoted, not to be homophobic, not to be transphobic. I think that they're looking for leadership from the adult world in this regard, and they respond really well to it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Taylor. I won't ask a question, but in my close as board chair, I'll slide in a couple of comments. I think we were privileged to have you present to us today. Your credentials are quite clearly impeccable in this world, and I think the information that you shared with the board was, for me, equally powerful and disturbing, and really a clarion call for policy and action. I somehow suspect that if you had the opportunity to present to 62 boards in the province of Alberta and several hundreds, if not thousands, of boards across the country, we would have policy within a very short period of a year to 3 years, because the information cries out for boards to take action. And I was also reminded several times in your presentation about the importance of regulations, because while policy creates the broad strokes, and clearly policy, standalone policy, can impact positively the safety and well-being of our sexual minority population, it's really critical that we have vigorous regulations that are the flesh on the bones of those policies and give principals and all staff members the guidelines and the ammunition to meaningfully change the culture within the school environment and create a better world for our sexual minority students and staff. So we're committed to doing that at Edmonton Public. We know we have a long journey ahead, but I think the resolve of the board is quite clear and firm in this area, and thank you for sharing all your information today. It was a privilege.
Well, you're welcome, and thank you again for having me here to speak to you. Much appreciated.
Thank you, Dr. Taylor. We are moving back to report number 3, the Audit Committee motion, and we're now about to consider recommendation number 3. So I will, that refers to the term of the Audit Committee. I will now open the floor up to trustee comments or questions on recommendation number 3. Trustee Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through you to administration, I'm wondering if they can comment on, given the initial response to the requirement for some sort of service for accountants in the community. I'm wondering if they can comment on the term of 3 years, if that's something that's typical when looking for service commitments to not-for-profit organizations or not.
Mr. Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's an annual thing that most of the professional accounting organizations have, so we have an annual reporting that we are required to do. So whether they do it for 1 year, 2 years, or three-year term, there's no real specific guidelines from the professional accounting associations. So we have to report annually as to how we what we do for these types of things.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Trustee Hoffman?
Also through you, Mr. Chair, administration comment on how they anticipate community members responding to a three-year term. Would that be a deterrent, or would that be something that would be attractive to have that opportunity for committed ongoing service?
Mr. Smith.
Mr. Chair, most of them would probably look at it favorably in the sense that it would be some continuity. They would get familiar with the organization, the structure, everything like that. So I don't see that being a difficulty at all.
Mr. Smith, Trustee Hoffman.
Nothing further. Thank you.
Further trustee comments? Trustee Ripley.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I'm interested in the notion of the audit committee external membership expiring on the same cycle as the election cycle, and I'm wondering about the wisdom of that. It seems to me that it would be a stronger thing actually to have the external members' term expire in the middle of a trustee term, so that say a whole new board is elected, there would be some continuity from the previous term in terms of the external members being there for another year to a year and a half to bring new trustees, brand new trustees, up to speed. So I think the three-year term is great. I would like to suggest that, in fact, the term expire in the middle of the trustee election cycle term. I haven't said that very clearly. So I guess I would propose an amendment. and that the term of the audit committee be 3 years for external members, with the first term set to expire in October 2014, and that the trustee terms be set for 1 year like all other trustee standing committees.
All right. Thank you, Trustee Ripley. We have an amendment on the floor. Opening the queue to trustee comments and questions, read the amendment. Trustee John.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That logic is sound from Trustee Ripley. I too believe that that it would be problematic to have it in 2013. I would certainly support the amendment for 2014, especially in light of the fact that we are 1 year into our term, and that would be a full 3 years. So that just makes sense to me that starting from now it would be 3 years, not 2 years, and then a three-year term. So I would support the 2014. That makes sense.
Thank you, Trustee John, or Trustee Cleary.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would view that as a friendly amendment to the motion.
Do I see any objection to that being taken as a friendly amendment? There is an objection. Okay, so that is not taken as a friendly amendment. But Trustee Cleary, did you want to offer any further comment in support of that amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I put that in there simply because I was thinking about the election term, and I just thought, okay, 3 years, just to make note of it. So if it is, in fact, a three-year term, then it does make better sense to specifically say when it would expire. So I believe that, as Trustee Ripley pointed out, that would be make logical sense to have the actual date to be October 2014. I don't believe that I can look into the future, so I don't know what that would look like, but appointing external members, let's just, for clarity, have it to read October 2014. Thank you.
Thank you, Trustee Cleary. Trustee Spencer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My objection is, and I guess it comes down to how I read the recommendation, I agree that continuity is very important. And with that in mind, having both terms for both of the external members expire at the same time doesn't make sense to me. I think it would be better to have it staggered so that one term ends in 2013, the other term ends in 2014, and then you continue down that cycle. That way, there's only one new external member coming aboard at a time, and there is always that continuity of having at least one person there. So I think that my preference would be to see overlapping terms. I would agree that the first term for one of the external members should expire in October 2013, and the first term for the other member of the Audit Committee should expire in October of 2014, and then we continue through with that pattern. So I hope that's clear, but that's the source of the reason why I couldn't be unanimous on the amendment proposed by Trustee Ripley.
Thank you, Trustee Spencer. I may ask you to put that amendment in some specific language, but perhaps in the interest of efficiency, I would canvass Trustee Cleary and the board on whether they would view that amendment to the amendment as a friendly amendment. And then we could dispose of all the formality of reading the motion into the minutes, et cetera, et cetera. Although I'm sure the minutes will capture the motion. Is that viewed as a friendly amendment? No, it is not. Okay, so we could you read, present the wording of your amendment to the amendment, Trustee Spencer?
Okay. That the term of the Audit Committee be 3 years for external members, with the first term for the first external member set to expire October 2013, and that the first term for the second external member be set to expire for October 2014. And then continuing, and that trustee terms be set for 1 year, like all other trustee standing committees.
And I did hear you reference in there the three-year term.
Yes, I'm not objecting to the three-year term. I just would like staggered expiry right. dates so that there's always continuity on the committee.
Okay, my colleagues are clear on the intent of the amendment, opening the floor up. Thank you, Trustee Spencer. Opening the floor up to comments or questions on the amendment. To the amendment. Trustee Ripley.
I'd like to ask the administration if the idea of staggered terms, that seems to make sense to me. Are there any risks or implications that we're not seeing about that idea?
Mr. Smith.
Mr. Chair, no objections at all.
I guess my second comment then would be whether Trustee Spencer, sorry, thinking Trustee Cleary down there, Trustee Spencer would think about the first term set to expire October 2014, the second one 2015. So we'd have one member to serve their first term 4 years, and then it would become a three-year term. Again, it's just that notion of every time at trustee election, there's a lot happening for not only the board, but for the administration in terms of getting a new board up to speed, et cetera. And so this would be one less. This would mean getting a new external member perhaps up to speed on the audit committee on an off-election year. Would be my rationale for that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Trustee Spencer.
I would just like to clarify with the administration that it would not be too difficult to be asking for someone to serve a four-year term on this committee.
Mr. Smith.
Mr. Chair, no, I don't see a difficulty asking to someone to extend it to the 4 year for the first time.
Thank you, Mr. Smith.
Thank you.
So I'm going to interpret, Trustee Ripley, your suggestion as suggesting a friendly amendment to Trustee Spencer, because my recollection of Robert's rules, Madam Secretary, is that it's not workable that we have more than two amendments on the floor at the same time. So we have an amendment to the amendment. This would be an amendment to the amendment to the amendment, and it's starting to go into the unwieldy world of where are we in this discussion. So, but I would be prepared to entertain this as a friendly amendment to Trustee Spencer's amendment. Would that be acceptable, Madam Secretary, or shall we just vote on the amendment to the amendment and then reopen the floor to a second amendment? Sorry.
My suggestion would be, from my understanding of Trustee Ripley's comments, that she accepts Trustee Spencer's amendment as friendly to her amendment. It's getting unwieldy.
Okay, so what I'm going to do then, the ruling from the, thank you, Madam Secretary, the ruling from the chair is we have two amendments on the table. We will dispose of the second amendment, then the floor would be open to a further amendment to the amended motion. Are we going down terra firma there, Madam Secretary?
I can figure it out.
In a roundabout way. Well, in any event, that's the ruling of the chair. So we have Trustee Spencer's motion before us with Trustee Ripley's thoughts floating about. Further comments or questions on Trustee Spencer's motion, Trustee Johnner. Trustee Spencer, did you want to offer some? Let me just take Trustee Johnner the cue for a minute.
Only if this is helpful, Mr. Chair, and that is I could withdraw my amendment to the amendment and rephrase it and put it back on the table. Would that be the easiest thing to do?
Would that be in order, Madam Secretary?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
All right. The amendment withdrawn.
Okay. I would like to make an amendment to the amendment suggested by Trustee beside me to my left. I forget her name all of a sudden. Trustee Catherine. That the term of the audit committee be 3 years for external members, with the first term for the first member set to expire October 2014, and the first term for the second member set to expire October 2015, and that the trustee terms be set for 1 year, like all the trustee standing committees.
Thank you, Trustee Spencer. Comments or questions to the amendment? Trustee John.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would support the amendment or the revised amendment by Trustee Spencer. Because staggering the dates makes sense, and that is a common practice for many boards or for many committees where terms are staggered to help with continuity. So I think that makes sense. Thank you.
Thank you, Trustee Johnner. Trustee Shipka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I propose them. Amendment. But just one concern I have is that we're looking at, with this proposal, 3 and 4 year terms. I mean, we are elected trustees. We serve 3 year terms. We're looking at potentially a member that we're appointing being 4 years. What happens if we're unhappy with this person or we have issues or this person, now we have only 3 trustees we'll be dealing with. If there are personality issues or clashes, it just seems to me a fairly long period of time to appoint someone. Especially extending to 4 years, I would prefer perhaps to go something like 1 year and 3 years and possibly 3 years out from there, but a little shorter term. I just have some concern about the length of time, Mr. Chair. I mean, possibility is have first a 1 year term to 2012, then to 2014. We're still bypassing the election year, but we're having a shorter term and see, evaluated at that time, how comfortable we are with this process and effective it is. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Trustee Shipka. I'll point out that after the disposition of this amendment, you're free to bring forward any further amendments, if it pleases you. Further trustee comments or questions to this amendment? Seeing none, calling the question on the amendment. All those in favor, please signify. And that would be Trustee Johnner, Trustee Shipka, Trustee Spencer, Trustee Ripley, Trustee Colvin, Trustee Hoffman, all those opposed. Trustee Cleary, the amendment is carried. Now, Madam Secretary, could you remind us where we are at in the disposition of recommendation number three.
Mr. Chair, officially you have amended the amendment, and you still have to take the vote on the amendment as amended.
On the amend, we're not back to the original or the amended recommendation.
No.
And what was the, I must confess, I've lost track of that first amendment that this amendment amended. What was that?
Trustee Ripley's amendment that it was only to extend both positions till 2014.
Okay. Opening the floor for comments or questions on the amended amendment. Seeing none, calling the vote on the only remaining amendment. All those in favor, please say.
As amended. Motion as amended.
The motion. Madam Secretary, could you move the motion?
Mr. Chair, that the term of the Audit Committee be 3 years for external members, with the first term for the first member set to expire October 2014, and the first term for the second member set to expire October 2014, and that trustee terms be set for 1 year like all other trustee standing committees.
So this is the amended recommendation.
Correct.
Thank you. All right. Someone is wants to speak, but I don't see any. Trustee Spencer.
Thank you. I believe one of the 2014 should be a 2015.
Okay, so corrected. Thank you, Trustee Spencer. Further comments or questions? Seeing none, calling the vote on the amended recommendation. All those in favor, please signify. And that would be Trustee Johnner, Trustee Shipka, Trustee Spencer, Trustee Ripley, Trustee Gould, and Trustee Hoffman. All those opposed, Trustee Cleary. We're done with this, correct, Madam Chair? I mean, Madam Secretary? Perhaps that was wishful thinking. Yes. All right, moving on to recommendation number four of the Audit Committee motion, and opening the floor to trustee comments or questions. Trustee Hoffman.
My only question to the mover would be the word accordingly, that the terms of reference for the Audit Committee be reviewed or revised accordingly. I'm not certain as to what accordingly means, so I'm just hoping for some clarification from the mover on that.
Trustee Clear.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do see that it's a bit cumbersome, so my intent was that the terms of reference for the decision today on the Audit Committee be reviewed what we currently have and then be revised on that basis. So I'd be happy to entertain an amendment to strike the word accordingly.
Trustee Hoffman, would you like to propose a friendly amendment in that regard?
Yeah, I would like to propose that and ask for consensus from my colleagues.
Does that have the support of the board?
Great.
It does. That is a friendly amendment. Trustee Hoffman, anything further?
Thank you. So with that in mind, I'm reading this recommendation for that administration review the terms of reference that the Audit Committee have, given the amendments that we made today, or the recommendations that were passed, recommendations 2 and amended recommendation 3, and that they bring back a recommendation report for new terms of reference for the Audit Committee. So I'd just like to see that that's indeed the consensus from the mover, and if so, then I absolutely support that.
Trustee Clear?
Yes, I do support that revision. Strike out the word accordingly.
Super. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Trustee Hoffman. Anything further on this recommendation? Seeing none, calling the vote on recommendation number 4. All those in favor, please signify. And that is carried unanimously. I think we will take let's go through one more item. I'm going to move forward to item number 4. I know we have some staff here that I believe are here to speak to that. So we're moving on to item number 5, and we'll go back to item number 4. Item number five, review of board policy IEC.BP, student admission to the district. I would call upon Trustee Cleary to introduce the report and move recommendation number one. Trustee Cleary.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On behalf of the Policy Review Committee, I move that the new board policy, IEC.BP, student admission to the district, attachment one, and the rescission of board regulation IEC.BR, student admission to the district, be considered for the first time. The committee reviewed the intent of this board policy and is recommending that it be updated to reflect current practices outlined in the report. In keeping with the board's desire to eliminate board regulations, it is recommended that this board regulation IEC.BR, student admission to the district, be replaced with the board policy IEC.BP, student admission to the district. And the intent of the policy is to make known the board's expectations with respect to student admission to the district.
Thank you, Trustee Cleary. Trustee, comments or questions? Trustee Shook.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have some concerns that if we're moving a regulation to a policy, that then our new regulation is going to be developed. These, as a policy, this seems quite specific, as it was a, or currently is a regulation. So that's one concern I have. Anyone wish to address that?
Mr. Superintendent.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is just an historical point that there was a point in time when the board would undertake what was called board regulations, hence the term IEC.BR, and that it was understood from a policy governance perspective that the board should be responsible for policy and that the administration is responsible for the regulation, which is the implementation practice related to that policy. And so an old board regulation that is in need of updating, and the question that the board is debating whether IEC.BP, the recommended policy that comes forward, is in fact a policy that meets with the current board's perspective on policy development. Mr. Chairman, it does give some specific information, but it does relate to current provisions of the School Act, which is also highly regulatory in terms of its definitions, and it simply brings district practice, trying to clarify district practice in relation to that, which would then also help in terms of our own regulation development. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Superintendent. Trustee Chip, anything further?
Yes, so Mr. Chair, so the administration will develop regulations if this should pass, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Superintendent?
Mr. Chairman, as needed, there are some fairly clear statements here already related to the School Act that would ensure that we would have, in the event we need to clarify for our staff, that we would create regulation as necessary in the event that there are some interpretation challenges from our staff, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my second question is, what happens if the proposed Education Act is not passed? Like a lot of these proposals on are quite specific, presuming that Bill 18 is passed. If not, then have we not passed something that would possibly need to be revised in again, Mr. Chair?
Mr. Superintendent.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As I understand it, this policy relates to the current School Act and will have to be adjusted in the event that a new Education Act is adopted by the provincial legislature.
Thank you, Mr. Superintendent. Trustee Shipka.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Trustee Spencer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Trustee Shipka just asked my question.
Thank you, Trustee Spencer. Trustee Huff.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I have a number of questions through you to administration. I appreciate that in the considerations and analysis that the what is being identified for the 1 through 6, but I'm really hoping for some clarity on the why. So why is it that we are, for example, in number 2, going to remove the point on number 2 says, statement that underage children will not be given access to programming unless they have a severe special need was removed. So when I read that, I wonder, is this currently a problem accessing special education for those underage children. If it is a problem, what have we done currently to try to address that? If it isn't a problem, then why are we putting this forward as a recommendation? So I'm hoping for some of the why for every one of the individual points. I can ask them individually, for example, why are we changing the that you have to affirm that you're a citizen. Why are we changing that to demonstrating proof of citizenship? And so on. I can ask them each individually for each of the sections if that would be easier, or if administration would be willing to respond to them collectively, that would be fine. Or if it would be beneficial to defer this, I would be happy to do that as well. But I would definitely appreciate some of the why understanding, as I wasn't a member of the policy committee. I'm guessing that some of this was discussed there, but not having had that opportunity to understand the rationale for why all of these changes are coming forward, I require that before I'm able to vote on this.
Mr. Superintendent.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, just to clarify, this refers the 6 points on page 2 is requiring some further rationale. Is that what is being requested?
Yeah, I'm specifically interested in what the motivation is to change each of these.
Okay.
So that I can understand if they are going to lead to more efficiencies in our district or to us serving students better or not. So the rationale answering the why questions would definitely be helpful for preparing myself and my ability to be able to vote on these recommendations.
I'll call on Mr. Klein to respond to the questions or the points that he is able to at this point. Thank you.
Mr. Klein.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. With regard to number one, the requirement of proof of citizenship and residency, that is a change that has come as a result of changes in the Albert Ed funding manual, and their requirements are that individuals have to provide a proof of citizenship and residency in order to be eligible to be registered in an Alberta school. Now, in saying that, at no time will any of our schools deny a parent the ability to register their child because they can't immediately provide that proof of residency or citizenship. The onus is on the school then to follow up with the parents to make sure that the individuals are in Canada legally and are also eligible for public education in Alberta within the both the School Act and, of course, the Alberta Education, both the Guide to Schools and the Funding Manual.
Please.
So if parents are unable or unwilling to produce that documentation, I know we're saying it's a school's responsibility to follow up, but let's say 3 months passes and parents don't get back to the school demonstrating that they are citizens or that they're here legally, then what?
Typically what would follow would be, it would really come down to what the situation were. For example, we have, if you want to look at proof of citizenship, we have many instances of school principals who have used school funds to get a birth certificate for children from families who are simply not able to provide a birth certificate. So in that case, the school has taken the onus upon themselves to provide that information. If we're talking about people who are coming from outside the country, who come to Canada, we are on a regular basis, we deal with the Department of Immigration, and they do follow up as well. So the information goes to Alberta Education. Alberta Education then will contact either our department in research, data, and knowledge, or the schools individually, and then we follow up through a combination, with immigration and also with the school authority. And typically, I would have to say I have never come across an instance where we have removed a child from a school because they couldn't provide that documentation.
Trustee Hall.
Thank you. That's definitely a concern of mine, that children who come for refuge in our public schools and rightfully find it there and a safe place, that I would have some hesitation should we pass this, that maybe they might read this as not having that opportunity to have that safe space of the school. So I'm glad that I hear that wouldn't be an outcome of it. I'm always hesitant to put things into policy, though, if I'm worried that might be read in at a later time, even though that's clearly not the intent of our district. Finally, with regard to number one, the change that is being made, was it a regulatory change, or can you give me some more background on that? Because I did I didn't see an amendment to any sort of legislation come through, so I'm wondering if this is something that's happened in a less obvious way, and when that happened, and why we're responding, I guess, at this point in time. Is this recent?
Mr. Klein.
Mr. Chairman, the change was as a result of a regulatory change with regard to school funding practice from school finance.
And that happened in this last school year?
Mr. Chairman, no. About roughly 20 months ago, this policy, it took some time to get it forward because of some changes.
Okay.
Trustee Hall.
That answers number one for me. If you could move forward to the second one about underage children not being given access to programming unless they have a severe special need being removed.
Mr. Klein.
Mr. Chairman, there was a change in policy with regard to, and if Dr. Raymond will permit me, I'll paint with a broad brush, early education students, because there are a variety of different categories that we use. There was a change in policy from Alberta Education with regard to these younger children insofar that if space was available and an early education site was in a community, that there could be community children could be allowed into these programs. These community children, the intent was for them to provide they call it a mentorship, if you will, or examples of these students would be individuals who are not special needs students, but by the same token, although Alberta Education was suggesting that our programs allow some of these students into the program, they are not prepared to fund these students. So in the past, our policy and regulations stated that unless you are a special needs student, you could not come into that program. But now, because of the change in practice where we're trying to get more children into these programs to provide a mixture of, so you don't have all special needs, and Dr. Raymond can run down here and beat me if I say the wrong thing, but we're trying to get these community students in there who act as mentors to these other children so they can see a mix of behaviors, if you will.
So, if I might, so these students being in these spaces they're still unfunded, or are they now funded by Alberta Education?
No, Mr. Chairman, the community students are unfunded by Alberta Education. They have suggested this is best practice, that we should have some of these students in. We, of course, agree that it is a good practice, and therefore we have allowed this to happen. And we register the students just as a regular student insofar as that's necessary, both from Alberta Education's point of view, but also with regard to liability within our schools, that all students need to be, who are in our schools, in our programs, must be registered.
Trustee Huffman.
Well, I absolutely agree with the concept of children under the age being required for education to have access to educational opportunities. I have some worry that if we put this at the district policy level, that any three-year-old in any neighborhood may choose to have a community position to have access to one of these programs in any school, and that if we're funding all preschool age children, or not funding, but if we're delivering educational services to children that aren't funded in our school level, I just have some concern about making this a district-wide policy, although I absolutely agree with sentiment, and I'm glad that in practice we've been doing this to a broad extent already in certain situations. I'm worried about making this a district-wide policy that takes away that onus to have a special education need and increase access to underage children. If that's that's a concern for me, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Superintendent.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The amended or changed part of the board policy is found on the amended policy, page 2, item G, towards the top of the page. F ensures that the item just above it, F ensures that students with severe handicapping conditions between the ages of 2 years, 6 months, and 4 years, 6 months will be, which admission is sought shall be provided by through an early education program. And so we meet the needs of those particular students in specific sites throughout our city called early education sites. An individual who is between 3 years and 6 months and 4 years, 6 months, and this is item G now, who resides in the attendance area, so there's the first provision. This is not open to anyone. It is to those who reside within the attendance area providing the early education program. So there's a restriction there. May be granted admission to early education programming as an unfunded community student. And so that the restrictions placed are based on the needs of that particular program within that particular attendance area, ensuring that the numbers are appropriate for that particular program. And so I think that there are sufficient provisions in place in this document that would not create the concern that has been viewed, and it's a legitimate one, that this would be open to all, you know, all three-year-olds, three-and-a-half-year-olds across the city. There are some specific provisions in place that I think protect the students as well as the district. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I hope that clarifies.
Thank you, Mr. Superintendent, and Trustee Huffman.
Thank you for drawing my attention to item G. So if I might just paraphrase, that you can be 3 years and 6 months plus, apply to your community school should there be an early education program there, which does ECS count as an early education program?
Mr. Superintendent.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Early education programming is very specific to students with severe handicapping conditions and is often available for students that are as young as 2 years, 6 months. It's a specialized program, and it is different from our typical ECS kindergarten type of program.
Thank you, Mr. Superintendent, Mr. Chair. So that I'm always thinking in my ward and example. So Hazeldine has an early education program, and community. I think that's the only one I have in my ward, and that community children who live in the catchment area for Hazeldine could apply to that program, and then they may be granted admission, assuming that we have all of the needs in place. And this is already happening, so it would be just formalizing that process.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That is correct.
Trustee Huffman.
Number two. I'm a little worried about using more board time to go through the rationale for each of these, but I do, so I might look to the chair to see, I could move to defer to the next board meeting and ask for that sort of follow-up rationale in a supplementary report, or we can continue through this if that's the board chair's willingness.
Mr. Superintendent.
Mr. Chairman, we'll be happy to supplement rationale for each of the remaining four items if that serves the board, Mr. Chairman. And it would not prevent the board from considering this board policy on a first or second reading basis.
Would that satisfy Trustee Huffman that this additional information will come before the board prior to a third reading?
So that we could pass
it
today.
So we can move through on readings number one and two with you having been satisfied for the first 2 points, and then additional information will be forthcoming from the administration prior to the board being asked to consider the policy for a third time.
So sorry, are we severing one and two from this? No, we can't do that because it's a collective. So we're asking, you're asking the board today to pass first and second reading on this without having the information, and then only having one opportunity after having the rationale at third reading.
I'm asking if that would satisfy you.
I would definitely like to have two opportunities to gauge the rationale before.
So what I would say is, while this has the appearance of taking up a fair bit of time, and in fact perhaps more than simply the appearance, my reading of our agenda for the balance of the meeting is that it is fairly late, and I think we should just continue on. And with the expectation that we will be able to conclude this and our other agenda items.
Okay, Spencer's in the queue.
Trustee Spencer, you had
nothing at this time.
Pardon?
Nothing at this time.
Oh, nothing. Okay. So then, Trustee Huffman, please.
Could administration please offer a rationale behind clarifying that adult students pay fees?
Mr. Klein.
Mr. Chairman. Under the funding manual of Alberta, A student must be, as it's stated in the documentation, an individual who is 19 years of age or older as of September 1st is eligible to attend a public school in Alberta. Once you are 20 years of age or older as of September 1st, then you are no longer eligible for public funding or to attend a public school. Typically, what that would mean would be adult students would then go to our Metro Continuing Education Facility, and because they're 20 years of age or older, would then pay the requisite tuition fees, dependent upon the program they take, how many courses along those lines.
Thank you, Mr. Klein. Trustee Hoffman.
Nothing further for that one.
Okay.
Thank you. Number four, modifying the reciprocal agreement, if there could be some rationale behind why we require that modification.
Mr. Klein.
Mr. Chair, the reciprocal agreement with Edmund Catholic at one point referred to students from Edmonton Catholic Schools as being non-resident. But because of changes in both funding and with regard to the taxation over the last number of years, that, as the superintendent stated, this original policy was somewhat aged, and it didn't really represent the realities of the situation. In Alberta, every student has the right to education in every school under the public-funded system. However, we have an agreement with Edmonton Catholic School whereby if a student is a special needs student and they come to our district, we have an agreement where Edmonton Catholic Schools would pay a sponsorship, which allows Edmonton Public to recover the cost of providing special education to that student. I can't really speak much more broadly to that. However, I believe perhaps someone from Budget Services might be able to, with regard to the detail.
Thank you, Mr. Klein. Would someone care to supplement, Mr. Superintendent?
I'll call on Ms. Hagan. I will clarify at this point, as she comes to the microphone, that the change here, we do have reciprocal agreements with a number of school boards when we enroll severe special needs students into our district, whereby we recover costs for programming for that particular student, and that those funds would continue as well. They would continue with Edmonton Catholic Schools. The stated difference here is that for moderate and regular students who are resident of Edmonton Catholic, we would be accepting them within Edmonton Public Schools without the sponsorship agreement.
So we do have tuition agreements, and those are approved basically at the same time budget is approved in the spring, and they would set the rates of what we would charge in the whole gamut.
Thank you, Ms. Hagan. Trustee Hoffman?
So would there be any new financial implications should we pass this policy, or are we already living in this financial reality, or would it actually change the agreement?
No, I don't think so, Board Chair, that it would change the agreement at all. It's all set in place to provide those tuition agreements.
So there'd be no financial implications?
No.
Okay.
Trustee Hoffman?
Thank you. I'm happy to move on to number five.
Thank you, Ms. Hagan.
The deletion of the section regarding property taxes.
Mr. Klein.
Mr. Chair, as I stated, this was an old regulation, and of course the issue of whether you have declared your property taxes one way or another is no longer something that we have to concern ourselves with for admission to the district. So it was determined that that would be deleted. It was no longer valid.
Might I ask?
Trustee Hoffman, please.
So it's my understanding that all of the funding we receive is on a per pupil basis. I'm just wondering if we should be doing any form of advocacy to remove the requirement to declare on your property taxes if we don't actually receive any funding based on that declaration. Mr. Chair.
Mr. Klein.
I don't think I'm really qualified to comment on that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Smith.
Mr. Chair, a number of the Catholic boards have opted out, and they require that to be collected and identified. So they have opted out, and they do collect they do pretend to collect taxes, I guess, is a way to look at it, is they identify their people and their students as Catholic on their property taxes, and they are allocated the funds based on that. But the government tops up everybody in their funding, so therefore what they collect in property taxes has to be supplemented from the province. So whether we have it identified or not, we did not opt out, and so therefore it has no effect on our funding at all.
Trustee Hoff.
And just a final clarification. So even if, let's say magically to the next round of property taxes, 99% of people say Edmonton Public, we would never receive additional funding. We would only ever receive the per pupil funding that we receive. So it's not it doesn't benefit the district to have somebody identify that they're public school supporter or vice versa, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Smith?
Mr. Chair, no. The actual money collected in property taxes is less than 30% of the funding we receive on an annual basis.
Trustee Hall.
Thank you for that. I think I can move on to number six.
Okay.
The coding being changed, it looks like the numbering of the regulation from a board regulation being identified as a coding for a board policy. So that's simply because we're moving it out of regulations and into our policy manual itself, Mr. Chair. Can you,
Mr. Superintendent? Mr. Chairman, that is correct.
Trustee Hoff.
Okay. That went much quicker, actually, than I thought it would. If I might speak to the recommendation as a whole, then, at mm-hmm. this point. I would personally find it helpful, I think, for those who might not be at the meeting and hear all of this rationale or maybe don't access it, to have a little supplemental report prior to third reading if there's consensus from others. I think that the responses that Mr. Klein gave here today is fantastic, and if that could be condensed into a small supplementary report around the rationale, I think that would be helpful to have that as a public document for the community members, if I might ask for agreement from my colleagues to do that.
Duly noted.
Super. That being said, my only hesitation is with number one, which I understand the province has already done. The province has already said that they require proof of citizenship. However, if we put that into policy, even though in action we would not turn a child away, and it hasn't been a problem to this point, I'm worried that if we put it in policy that if you don't provide proof of citizenship that you will not have a right to education, that could in some way down the road have negative implications for a student or more, who knows, but I always have to try to picture sort of those far off scenarios and how that might impact education, quality of public education, and the universality of and accessibility of public education in the city of Edmonton. So that being said, I guess my question would be, if we did not change that wording, if we did not say that we require them to prove citizenship, but we acted upon requesting proof of citizenship, would that be problematic? Through you, Mr. Chair, to administration.
Mr. Klein?
Mr. Chair, the intent is to follow the changes that are in the funding manual, which is the regulations under which we follow. We have to show, I suppose the term would be due diligence in following those regulations, because it is enabling our practice. However, reality being such that, as I stated earlier, our schools do not turn students away. They make every effort to find the documentation, to work with parents to get the required documentation. However, students are not turned away based on the fact they do not have the proof of citizenship. We do as much follow-up as is possible. Alberta Education does follow-up as well. They do citizenship audits that we work with the schools and with the parents to provide. There are instances where we have come across individuals who the parents have remained here after they are legally entitled to be in Canada, and that is something that's taken up with immigration, the Department of Immigration, and also with Alberta Education. In all of the cases I'm aware of, no student is removed from school. Actually, in a couple of instances I know of, the students have allowed to be finished of their program.
Trustee Hoffman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that was the exact scenario that I was sort of picturing, where the children of potentially temporary foreign worker whose work permit has expired, who chooses to stay in this country for whatever reasons, and Edmonton Public's forced to do some of that sort of investigative work as opposed to providing education. We're asked to be policing whether or not our students are Canadian citizens or those kinds of things. I guess philosophically, I disagree with that. I don't think that that's our job. And if the regulations have been changed by the province, maybe that's something that I'll ask the advocacy committee to consider for future advocacy efforts. But I appreciate why we're trying to put our policy in line with that of the policies of Alberta Education. It's our job. But I don't agree that our job is to spend school educational dollars printing birth certificates or educational dollars, administrative time for support staff that could be spent in the school helping children trying to track down these documents because the province wants us to assist them in those efforts. So that is frustrating for me. I'll bring that forward to advocacy, and I thank you for that background. But I don't have concerns around the specific policy, just the government regulations, I guess. Thank you.
Thank you, Trustee Hoffman. Thank you, Mr. Klein. Sure. Further trustee comments or questions to recommendation number one? Seeing none, calling the vote on this recommendation. All those in favor, please signify. And that is carried unanimously. Trustee Cleary, I ask you to move recommendation number two, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that new board policy IEC.BP, student admission to the district, attachment one, and the rescission of board regulation IEC.BR, student admission to the district, be considered for the second time.
Thank you, Trustee Cleary. Trustee comments or questions? Seeing none, calling the vote on recommendation number two. All those in favor? That is carried unanimously. I will now call a 14-minute recess, and we will resume at 4:05. Yes, Trustee Spencer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm hoping perhaps the administration could bring back an update on the status of the webcast of this meeting. I understand that there are problems today. So when we come back from the break.
There's problems with the webcast today?
Yes.
Okay.
So if we could have any information on that, I appreciate it.
Thank you, Trustee.